This program is brought to you by PersonalLifeMedia.com.
From time immemorial, beginning with indigenous councils and ancient wisdom traditions, through the work of Western visionaries such as Plato, Galileo, and quantum physicist David Bohm, mutually participatory dialogue has been seen as the key to evolving and transforming consciousness, evoking a flow of meaning, a Daya flow of logos, meaning, beyond what any one individual can bring through alone. So join us now, as together with you, the active deep listener, we evoke and engage in living dialogues. Welcome to Living Dialogues. I'm your host, Duncan Campbell, and with me for this particular dialogue, I'm really delighted to have Dwayne Elgin. Dwayne Elgin is an author, speaker, evolutionary activist, and internet entrepreneur. He is the author of Voluntary Simplicity, Awakening Earth, and Promise Ahead, A Vision of Hope and Action for Humanity's Future. Dwayne is a former senior social scientist at SRI International at Stanford University, where he co-authored numerous studies on the long-range future for the Environmental Protection Agency, the President's Science Advisor, and the National Science Foundation. He holds an MBA from the Wharton School and an MA in Economic History from the University of Pennsylvania. He lives in the San Francisco Bay Area. So, Dwayne, what a pleasure to have you on the program again.
Well, it's good to be here, Duncan. Thanks for having me.
One of the things I thought we might do in this particular program is to perhaps give an overview of your life and work, particularly perhaps beginning with when you first heard the call of what would become your life work, perhaps in boyhood. You know how Joe Campbell talks about how oftentimes in adolescence, we first get a glimpse of the grail, and then it's later in life that we find the full-blown mission. And so perhaps you could talk about your own life in that perspective.
Well, let's see. I grew up on a farm in Idaho, and my earliest recollections are of the connection with the earth, connection with animals. And my mother was a nurse, and so also and then a connection with healing. And I think those elements really weave together in my life, a feeling for nature, a feeling for the need for healing of humanity. And in different ways, those have woven into my life. And I did work, after getting out of graduate school, for 2 years back in Washington, D.C. on a presidential commission looking 30 years ahead at the American future. And for a farm boy from Idaho to be plopped down in the middle of a presidential commission looking at the deep future, that was an extraordinary education. And the biggest part of the education really was seeing that people weren't looking 30 years ahead. They weren't looking 10 years ahead. They were looking maybe only one or two. And basically, I thought someone would be minding the store, and I discovered that they weren't. And so I left Washington, moved to California, began working at the Stanford Research Institute, and that's where, as you say, I ran into Joseph Campbell. And my first job there working at SRI really was working for a year looking at the deep archetypes, the deep stories, the deep images that we hold about ourselves as a human family. Are we builders? Are we warriors? Are we healers? And so on. And I remember this conversation I had with Joseph Campbell in 1972-73. And I was asking him about, well, what is the story that we have as a whole human family? Where are we going as a species? And he turned to me and he said, well, how should I know? He said, all of the stories I know about are tribal stories. They're stories about groupings, and they're not stories about the whole human family, and we have yet to discover that story, he said. And so that launched me on then what became, from, say, 1973, a 20-year process of inquiry and writing about do we have a larger story? And indeed, I think we do, and that story is described in the book Awakening Earth that was finally published in 1993, 20 years after this conversation with Joseph Campbell. And in the interim before that, I wrote another book, Voluntary Simplicity, and I wrote that not because I had any expertise, but because I realized from my years of research that I had a lot to learn about living sustainably on this earth. And so I wrote that as much for myself as a learning experience as I did for anyone else. And that was then published in 1981. And lastly, the last book I published was in 2000, and that's the book Promise Ahead, which kind of summarizes all this work over the last 30-some years. And the last thing I would toss into the mix, kind of giving an overview of my life and the influences, in the 1980s, I spent that decade doing community organizing in the San Francisco Bay Area primarily on the whole theme of media accountability, and specifically television and broadcast television, and not only how it's really maybe polluting the collective mind with gratuitous sex and violence, but it's also there's an impoverishment of the collective mind by the absence of attention to things like climate change and species extinction. So another part of my life and work has been grassroots organizing for media accountability. So in addition to the writing, there's been that work as well. So that's kind of a quick overview of the last 30-some years.
Well, Duane, that's very elegantly stated, and I think one of the things that draws it all together is that passion that you had early on, as you described, even in your childhood, for the earth, a connectedness with a web of life and a feeling for the planet as a whole, as embodied in the earth, which is our home.
Yeah.
And then going to Washington, D.C., and in a sense being surprised to see that unlike the Native American heritage of this continent, people were not thinking seven generations ahead. In fact, rarely are they thinking more than the next political election ahead or the next quarter on Wall Street.
Indeed. Yeah.
And with that, your conversation with Joseph Campbell, I think, is very striking because there was a similar interview with Joe Campbell that appeared in Paul Ray and Sherry Anderson's excellent book, The Cultural Creatives, in which Joe, for all of his great wisdom and knowledge, said that basically he had prepared the ground for a new vision to come through, but he was not the one to bring it through as such. And you have embarked on that great work and in recent times have published an article entitled The Self-Guiding Evolution of Civilizations, which in article form, in a sense, summarizes and brings up to date your evolutionary vision as well as your activism. So perhaps we could use that as a bridge now to talk about your own vision of what is emerging as a planetary consciousness and how does it fit into the evolutionary paradigm? Where are we on the evolutionary ladder, if you will?
Yes. Well, here's what I've discovered over the years since that conversation with Joseph Campbell. First of all, I thought it was quite extraordinary that we would enter this time of a global testing and challenge. If we didn't have a story, it just seemed like it would be natural that somewhere that story would be present. And so I began asking people about 10 years ago, as I would go around different parts of the United States and different parts of the world, I began asking people the following question. When you look at the whole human family and you look at our behavior, what life stage do we seem to be in when you look at our behavior? Are we behaving like toddlers? Are we behaving like teenagers? Are we behaving like adults? Are we behaving like elders? And I've asked that question in India, in Brazil, in Europe, in Japan, the United States, in all kinds of circumstances, and what I've discovered is quite extraordinary, is that people within seconds have an answer. And when given the choice between toddler, teenager, adult, and elder, immediately between two-thirds and three-quarters will raise their hands and say, we're in our teenage years as a human family. Now, what I gather from that is that at an intuitive level, we know there's a story being played out here. Joseph Campbell's story that he was looking for is already resident in our own intuitions about where we are as a whole human family. And we look around, we see that we're in our teenage years, we're about to move into this, what appears to be a rite of passage, a time of initiation as a whole human family. And that's a time to move from adolescence and into our early maturity. And so I think that is the story that we were searching for, that we're in a stage of natural organic evolution from our adolescence to our early adulthood. And the, one of the critical stages in becoming an adult is the whole idea of just taking a hard look in the mirror. And that's reflective consciousness. It's saying, wait a minute, who am I? What am I doing here? What are my life choices really about? And that kind of reflective taking assessment of yourself is a major step in maturation, and that's the step we need to make, we're beginning to make at not only a personal level, but also at a social civilizational scale. And that brings in then the mass media.
And before we get onto that, we might linger on this great overarching vision of humanity being in a stage of teenagehood or adolescence, something that has been observed as well by a number of other people in different angles or perspectives, we might say. Richard Tarnas, in his great book, The Passion of the Western Mind, sees an overarching meta-narrative very similar to that that you describe, in which he feels that at this point in time, we're reaching the end of a kind of masculine initiatory crisis, that we might say the species as a whole, when it was originally appearing in the evolutionary paradigm, and the move from living cell organisms to the human species, a great evolutionary leap that we came out of, we might say, a matrix, a womb of feminine energy and a kind of childhood of the species, which you describe, for instance, in Awakening Earth, where you talk about how having begun for maybe 1 or 2 million years embedded in nature in a relatively contracted or unreflective consciousness, as the human species moves into the hunter-gatherer phase and then into the agrarian phase and in the industrial phase, which is now coming to a close, we developed a greater and greater complexity of this self-reflective consciousness, which would be analogous to the adolescent separating from the embeddedness in the family and striking out to individuate and explore the world and to test his or her powers of independence, and then at some point has to return to a kind of embeddedness, if you will, from a conscious, voluntary perspective in the wider community and bring back the gifts of that intense exploration.
Yes.
And so we have Deepak Chopra talking about the species being in adolescence, and Bob Keck, in a wonderful book called Sacred Quest, had a beautiful phrase saying that the species attitude, especially in our Western culture at present, to the environment is that of a teenager to the refrigerator. And I thought that was really interesting, because you can see that as we're sort of fascinated with growth, we're impelled by a kind of cosmology that understands growth to be good, not necessarily in a balanced way of a feedback loop modeling on nature, but on this sense of the Newtonian Cartesian model that fueled the Industrial Revolution, that more growth is better and a rising tide will lift all boats, but somehow there's no mature understanding of where all these resources that fill the refrigerator are coming from, or how we're responsible to make sure that they're self-renewing. And so from that perspective, I would invite you to comment on that notion of our attitude toward the environment and how it might shift before we move on to the role of the media.
Okay. Well, just taking the theme you were speaking to earlier about being in our teenage years and moving into our early adulthood, given the feedback that I got from around the world, I became very curious about teenage psychology, adolescent psychology. And I began to see there were a number of parallels between humanity's behavior and that of teenagers. And teenagers, for example, are rebellious. And here we are as a human family rebelling against nature, trying to prove our independence from nature. Teenagers are reckless, and here we are consuming with rather reckless disregard for the future of the human family and other species. Teenagers are often into appearance, and here we are as a materialistic consumer society really into appearances. Teenagers are often into instant gratification, and we have this very short time frame as a human family. Now, someone once said, humorously, teenagers are God's punishment for enjoying sex. Now, but there's an upside here to our being in the teenage years. Teenagers are also courageous, and teenagers are also daring, and they're willing to work really hard, and they have idealism. So if we take some of the strengths of the teenager, the adolescent, and apply those to the whole human family at our time of crisis, ecological crisis and such, I think we can rise to the occasion. And in rising to the occasion, it means we're going to rise into our early adulthood, and we're going to pull together as a human family. And just like a teenager now, when they move into early adulthood, they start thinking about the family, about the future, about meaningful work. If we just did that much as a human family, if we said, okay, we'll start thinking about the whole human family, about the work we're doing here on the earth, and about our future together, that would be an extraordinary shift in collective consciousness, and it would be very natural, just as you see the natural evolution with teenagers.
Well, we could also mention now, as we move on to the media, that the famous Nike slogan, "Just Do It," could be seen in either perspective. It could be seen as reckless, or it could be seen as daring and cutting through the kind of hesitation and constant questioning that may come with age. On the negative side, as Paul Goodman was fond of saying, sometimes adults have the, quote, "nothing can be done" disease. So there's that sense that, the teenager in the positive sense, or youth in general, have that sense of possibility and willingness to test new frontiers. And of course, as you say, it can be reckless. And it brought to my mind, as you were speaking, probably the most often seen ad during the Olympics, "Do what feels good." And I think it was for Coca-Cola or Pepsi-Cola, I can't remember, but "do what feels good." It seemed to me, again, to have that sense of pandering to the instant gratification. And yet at the same time, there are people in the teenage years and in what Eric Erickson called youth, that extended period of post-adolescence from around the age of 18 to the age of 30, that is a transitional stage in our highly complex technology-oriented civilization that precedes adulthood, that have articulated the goals of society, the stated goals, with a lot of passion, and they do hold a certain kind of wisdom because of their familiarity with this rapidly changing technology and their passion for creating a world that will live as long as they do. And so what I'm thinking of is Eric Erickson's great invitation to this ethical dialogue between the elder generations and the younger generations. And how do you see the possibility of conducting that dialogue about values, Duane, given the fact that the media, which would be the normal conduit for us to share this reflective consciousness between generations, is apparently completely in the hands of a non-reflective and relatively manipulative consumerist consciousness?
Indeed. I think the whole issue of generational reconciliation that you're bringing up is really important, as is gender reconciliation around racial differences and income and on and on. And the first step towards reconciliation is mutual understanding. If we don't understand one another, we can't really respect one another and come to some common ground with one another. And understanding comes out of communication, and we have an enormous communications gap in our society when you look at all the divisions that exist both within this country and then the rest of the world. And as I look at our evolution as a human family, it seems to me it comes down in many respects to communication. I think it was our ability to communicate that it got us this far to the verge of an effective planetary civilization. It will be our ability to communicate that will get us toward a sustainable, more compassionate, creative planetary civilization. And we look around, and we're in the midst of an extraordinary communications revolution with not only television or visual communication, but also with the Internet and digital forms of communication. It's amazing the power of mass communication that's cooking away in the world now. And at the very time that we need to be empowered to communicate our way through this time of crisis, we have the tools of mass communication around us more than enough to do that if we'll use those for that purpose. And that means we have to look beyond consumerism and materialism and such as the guiding principles for orienting and running our mass media.
One of the things you said in your recent article that I mentioned earlier is that, and I quote, "By programming television to achieve commercial success, the mindset of entire nations is being programmed for ecological failure."
Yeah.
"The mass media are perpetuating and reinforcing a consumerist mindset at the very time that we need to bring an ecological mindset into our collective consciousness." End of quote. And then you go on to say the conclusion seems inescapable that although television is at the heart of our capacity for social knowing, it is now being used in a way that is dysfunctional and counterproductive to meeting our immense evolutionary challenges.
Exactly.
And so let's talk directly at this point then, Duane, about the fact that having experimented passionately with grassroots activism in the 80s, you, in a sense, took another path during the 90s and are now coming back in a new way to that challenge of how to bring the mass media into a responsible role in promoting this kind of essential dialogue.
Yes. I want to acknowledge, first of all, in talking about this, that the most natural response is to say, well, it's just hopeless. These media giants are so enormous, and they have so many resources that this is just a hopeless enterprise to try and do anything to have the mass media, specifically broadcast television, be at all responsive to our needs and interests as a public.
It certainly appears so to many, many people.
Exactly. And so, first of all, I want to acknowledge that fact. And then secondly, many people say, well, look, I don't know anything about the mass media. I don't have any expertise there. But the reality is the average person watches a little more than 4 hours of television a day. And the average person is incredibly expert when it comes to the issue of television. 98% of all American homes have a TV set, and that's more than have indoor toilets, stoves, and refrigerators. And it means the TV set is the most common fixture we have in our collective lives as a country. And
extraordinary.
It is. Now, by law, and there's a law going back more than 75 years that says television broadcasters use the public airwaves. And anyone that uses the public airwaves must first of all serve the public interest, period. End of discussion. Now, the problem is that we, the public, have never said what's in our public interest. And so by default, we allow broadcasters to say, well, we know what's in your interest, and we're going to provide it to you, and it's commercialism, materialism, and so on. And so I'm not faulting, actually, the broadcasters. I'm faulting us as citizens. And it's time for us as citizens to come together, shoulder to shoulder, and say, we may have many differences between us, but we stand together and saying to you as broadcasters, you can do a better job. There's too much gratuitous sex and violence, or there's not enough programming about climate change, species extinction, and all the rest. And let's up-level the communication that dominates the social brain of our collective society.
And so, Duane, I have to pose the question to you that you did attempt grassroots organizing in the 80s in this same perspective.
Indeed.
And then you regrouped, as it were, for a decade, and you're coming back at it now.
Yes.
What is it that makes you feel any more hopeful today, if indeed you do, that progress can be made in even the long term, much less the near term?
Yes. Well, first of all, I feel hopeful because I've made so many mistakes over the last 20 years that I have a much better sense of what not to do. And that's very, very important to know what are unproductive paths for really taking on these media giants and asking them to be responsive to the public interest.
Well, please share those.
So I am hopeful because I understand the power of the law and the extent to which these broadcasters should be accountable to the public interest. And if we, the public, come together, that is all that's required to really transform, I feel, the quality of communication happening through these dominant media. So there really is an opportunity here, despite the powerlessness that many people feel. There's actually an extraordinary opportunity to up-level the quality and maturity of our collective communications here.
Now, Duane, is it any different than the opportunity that was present in the 80s?
Is yes. What's different is, for example, the Internet is making it possible right now to begin organizing a national campaign easily with just a handful of people, whereas in the 80s it would have required an enormous number of people, an enormous amount of effort. And so the ability to organize and to communicate has been incredibly amplified with the use of the Internet, and that is a key resource that we're using for this organizing purposes. So I think that is the biggest single factor. In addition, I think we've got a generation of folks that are much more media savvy. They see the power of the mass media, and they've grown up with it, and they're not happy about it, and they're ready for change.
Well, so in our last minute or two, I want to quote once again from your recent article where you say that it is primarily through our, quote, social brain, i.e. the television system and its interconnected computer and satellite networks, that the mindset of the species will be established and cultivated. How we use our tools of mass communication is not just another issue. It is the basis for understanding and responding to all issues. End of quote. And so perhaps in the last minute or two here, you could just make a comment about how you're proceeding on that basis and tell people how they can get a hold of you if they'd like to connect further on this issue.
Yes. The easiest way to see how we're proceeding and to get a hold of us would be to go to our website. The organization is called Our Media Voice. So the website is ourmediavoice.org, all one word. And on the website, you'll see all kinds of resources for learning, seeing what the rights are, and they're very profound rights that citizens have, to ways of getting involved, from filling out an online survey, sending in a petition, writing letters, and so on. So there are a range of ways to be engaged in a very practical way in this whole initiative.
Well, Duane, thank you so much for sharing these thoughts with us today on this program, and I would encourage our audience to follow up by connecting with ourmediavoice.org. And, Duane, I have to say it's a great pleasure, as always, to spend time with you and your brilliant reflections on our personal and social future.
Thank you for having me, Duncan.
I'm your host, Duncan Campbell. I've been with Duane Elgin, author of three remarkable and extraordinary books. One is called Voluntary Simplicity, another, Awakening Earth, and his most recent book, Promise Ahead, A Vision of Hope and Action for Humanity's Future. Be with us again next time on Living Dialogues. And once you have entered your free subscription to the Living Dialogues podcast here on Personal Life Media, future Living Dialogues will automatically be downloaded to your computer on a weekly basis. If you'd like to obtain a full transcript of this dialogue or additional dialogues I've done with the many other transformational thinkers listed on my website, livingdialogues.com, that's living, DIALOGUES.com. You can contact me at duncan@personallifemedia.com. Thanks again for your deep listening. All the very best. And stay tuned now after the music for some very interesting opportunities available to you as a listener to Living Dialogues.
Find more great shows like this on PersonalLifeMedia.com.